Mary Ann Bruins is Associate Professor of Soil Microbiology in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Management at the Pennsylvania State University and University Park, where she teaches soil ecology and soil microbiology. She received BA and MS degrees from the University of Nebraska and a PhD in crop and soil science at Michigan State University. She served as chair of the Soil Biology and Biochemistry Division of SSSA in 2009. Her research focuses on soil microbial responses to agricultural management and land reclamation. Marianne.
If you want to go forward, yeah, just go ahead.
And the mouse?
Yeah, the mouse will point it so they can record it.
Oh, yep. Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you. Yep. All right, thank you very much for inviting me to speak at this symposium. I wanted to start with a definition of ecological disturbance. Okay, disturbance is defined as any force or event that causes the mortality of organisms and or changes the spatial patterns of organismal distribution. So with this slide, I want to welcome you to the Anthropocene. Okay, it's a new geologic era that we are currently in, and it is characterized by the fact that humans have become the most powerful biological and geological agents of disturbance. And as a result, we are undergoing very rapid changes in energy use, population, and environmental degradation. So I would have to say that the concept of the Anthropocene started or was highly promoted by Paul Crutzen. He is the atmospheric chemist who won the Nobel Prize for articulating the causes and consequences of the destruction of the ozone layer. And what is important also to recognize is that the Anthropocene is the successor to the Holocene epoch. The Holocene is lasting only 12,000 years as opposed to all of the other geologic epochs that came before it. And those epochs lasted for at least 2 million years. So we're undergoing an acceleration in environmental degradation, and it's thought that the Anthropocene started with what we call the Great Acceleration in the mid-20th century, which was resulting from rapid population increase, rapid industrialization, and a great deal of energy use. Whoop. Well, let's see. I think I have... Okay, there we go. The theme of my talk is plant soil disturbance is really an essential component of agriculture. So I do want to focus on the land use of agriculture for my talk. And it's got four parts. I want to talk about the impacts of disturbance on plant soil microbial systems. I want to also talk about the differences between what I call anthropocentric and biocentric approaches to agriculture. I'm also going to describe a new policy tool called functional land management, which is a tool to try and balance demand and supply of functions carried out by soils. And then I'm going to end up with describing implications for human health, especially focusing on the soil function of processing and recycling organic waste. Okay, so what I want you to do is think about agricultural land conversion and the requirement for physical disturbance and biological disturbance. If you can imagine this tropical forest and the rich above-ground vegetation that existed, it was also partnered with a very rich below-ground community of symbiotic and endophytic fungi, bacteria, and many, many different trophic levels existing within the soil. During land conversion, destruction of vegetation, either by clear-cutting or burning, is accompanied by the destruction of the below-ground community that probably developed over centuries. So agricultural land conversion necessarily causes the disruption of what are presumably very ancient networks that have supported vegetative growth above ground for all those years. So this is a good example of the impacts of, first of all, agricultural land conversion, but also repeated disturbances as a result of continued use of land for agriculture or grazing or other human uses. This is a photograph of the highway that is a boundary between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And you can see the tremendous difference in the soil health and the degree of erosion that occurred in Haiti. This photograph was taken before the 1980s. If you take an aerial photograph today, the two sides are really quite similar in their appearances, which again shows the tremendous rate of environmental degradation that has occurred since that time. So what I want to again try and impress upon you is the different impacts of disturbance that are resulting from land conversion. You have root losses, alterations of root architecture, disintegration of the symbiotic networks that connected the above and below ground systems. There are fewer stable interspecies relationships as a result of the disruption. There is thought to be a reduction in fungal representation in the biological community because physical disturbance disrupts hyphal networks. And so as a result, you have a much greater dominance of free-living bacteria, a loss of keystone species, fewer trophic levels, reduced soil structure, poorer aggregation, and just faster losses and leakage of soil, water, and nutrients. So these are conceptual diagrams to show you the differences in the linkages between above ground and below ground communities before and after land conversion. So here, prior to disturbance, primary production really fueled and fed the below ground communities. And the below ground communities, you can see here, consist of a very vast array of interactions among and within trophic levels, where you have detritus and residues from primary production serving as the food source for diverse fungi, bacteria, and other saprophytic organisms. And these biological interactions serve to build a base of humus and stable organic matter that help to create better structure for the soil. And above all, these microbivores and detritivores serve as important food and prey for larger fauna that are important for disturbance that is indigenous. So there is a type of disturbance that is happening in these soils. It's a type of biotic disturbance that is smaller scale, slower, but probably just as important in the development and the maintenance of these biological interactions. But just when we have agricultural land conversion, those interactions are disrupted. So again, this shows you sort of the depauperate interactions and linkages above ground and below ground that occur after agricultural land conversion, where you have primary production that is directed mainly for human use and a much lower complexity biological system that occurs below ground. So these are very, very strongly contrasting systems, but this type of system is really characteristic of agriculture today. And as a result, you have tremendous loss of soil function. The detritus and the humus and the organic matter that is supporting the biological interactions are much more likely to be lost, and as a result, soil structure degrades and soil function is detrimentally affected. One of the things that I think many of us soil microbiologists are experiencing now is this fascination with next generation sequencing. And yes, I think there's a lot of interest in soil microbial community composition, but what I think has happened is that there's been a lot of resources put into trying to understand the prokaryotic community composition in soils. Well, I would argue that the higher trophic levels in soils are probably much more important for soil function and soil stability. And One good piece of evidence there is that prokaryotes or bacteria and archaea can stay for very long periods of time in severely degraded soils. A good example is Darwin's dust. This was dust collected by Charles Darwin that was sealed for 175 years. And Gorbashina and colleagues plated out this soil, and after 175 years, they found 90,000 CFU per gram of viable organisms. So again, it tells you that perhaps these prokaryotes are really not contributing to a great extent to soil function. Okay, so I tried to give you an understanding of how soil biotic communities are changed as a result of agriculture and how we need to take that into a greater account. What I want to do is talk about approaches to disturbance in agriculture that are either anthropocentric or biocentric. Anthropocentric agriculture is really what characterizes this great acceleration starting in the 20th century, where we have agriculture that was really dependent on petrochemical inputs. And as a result, we have farmed without much consideration at all to the maintenance of organic matter and soil biota. This has resulted in leaky systems where we incur heavy erosive losses of soil, inefficient nutrient use. Less than half of our nitrogen that's applied on an annual basis ends up in crops. And as a result, we have water pollution, eutrophication, and really maldistribution, excesses and deficits of nutrients around the world. So we'll continue with anthropocentric agriculture. What has happened is we have erosion on a global basis that is 5 to 40 times greater than what rates we have for soil formation. We also have amounts of reactive nitrogen that have increased by 120%, and more than 50% of the Earth's land surface has been transformed for human use. This map from the United Nations Environmental Program shows that the majority of soil, the majority of land that is either ice-free or without vegetation, the majority of land that is accessible to humans has been either degraded or severely degraded. So these are critical aspects of trying to address the ignoring of the biological and organic components of soil. Biocentric approaches to disturbance, or biocentric agriculture, on the other hand, really does recognize the basis of the biotic interactions and complexity of soil biology. It recognizes that the base of the biotic interactions is indeed organic matter, and we are seeing today a much greater adoption of no-till systems or reduced tillage systems, a greater emphasis on use of cover crops, interseeding, and just growing green, constantly keeping soil cover to protect the soil from erosion and to restore the organic matter base of the soil. And I think especially farmers nowadays, and because of what Tom also alluded to earlier about the emphasis on soil health with the program in NRCS, I think we really understand much better that soil function is truly dependent on organic matter and also on the maintenance of a biological component that is absolutely critical to soil function. This is a little diagram that kind of brings home the fact that the red square represents the carbon that is contained within the live biomass, whether it's bacteria, fungi, protozoans, nematodes, other fauna. And it's important to recognize that each unit of carbon in the living biomass really is derived from 100 times the amount of carbon, and that is absolutely essential to soil function. The other aspect of this slide here shows that although soil organic matter is the base of the web, of the food web, it's really important to have greater numbers of different trophic levels to interact, and also for the mixing and burrowing and ecosystem engineer activity that is carried out by the larger trophic levels, because these are going to be particularly critical in maintenance of soil structure and maintenance of soil function. Just to quickly show how the differences in crop residue and soil structure can be seen in no-till and plowed systems. And I think there is a growing recognition that soil structure equals function, that the importance of soil aggregation in maintaining soils in place and preventing erosion and improving nutrient recycling is absolutely essential and attributed to the biotic component of soils. So what I want to do is impress again on you the importance of the biotic component for soil functions. And by doing so, I want to introduce a new policy tool which is being developed in the European Union. This is called functional land management. And it's a policy framework that is based on the recognition that soils have five functions. Of course, in agriculture, the most important function is primary production. But the other four functions are water purification and regulation, as pointed out by Tom DeSutter, carbon sequestration, also provision of diversity, and use of soil as a reservoir for waste recycling. So I'll talk about that in a little bit here. This policy tool was derived from a group in the European Union, and one of the leaders is Roger Schulte. This is an article that came out in Frontiers in Environmental Science just in late 2015. And this is a tool that is based on recognition of five soil functions. And the soil functions have been portrayed in their soil matrix that they are using for land use planning. So in this matrix, you'll see that soils are divided into three main classes: well-drained, moderately drained, and poorly drained. I think that after speaking with Roger Schulte, who came to Penn State under the auspices of a Soil Health for One Health project that we have started, he has pointed out that soil taxonomists are often bogged down in details and often make it difficult for people to relate to soils. So they're using these very simple classifications of soil and relating them to different land uses, as you can see across, such as farm, crop production and bioenergy and forests. But what you see here is each block represents a distribution of these five functions that are based on the different colors. And obviously, arable soils that are well-drained are going to be primarily best for primary production, whereas perhaps poorly drained soils are going to be more important for carbon sequestration. This matrix has been designed and is being applied countrywide to look at the supply of these soil functions based on different soil types and soil series or orders across across these countries. And then policymakers are then looking at demand for these soil functions. So the matrix is, and the policy framework is being used to try to match soil function supply with demand. And again, I think the whole idea of maintaining soil functionality is absolutely critical to this. And then the final part of my talk really focuses on that fifth soil function, which is use of soils as a repository for waste processing and the implications for human health. I mean, I think when we talk about soils, it's important to make a distinction between organisms that are residents of soil and which can become opportunistic pathogens when they are displaced. A good example would be Coccidioides immitis, which is the causative agent of valley fever in California Central Valley, for instance. We also, but at the same time, we also have cases that were mentioned by Tom DeSutter about exposure of soils actually enhancing immune responses. So it can go both ways. But in this case, Coccidioides is being displaced and posing a health risk. Another type of pathogen of concern would be the pathogens that are introduced to soils with anthropogenic inputs like animal manures. And I think we have really good evidence to know that pathogens can survive and persist for significant periods in soil. Also, interestingly, it's been found that some strains of E. coli can actually become naturalized. And we don't know the health implications. It's quite possible that a lot of these naturalized E. coli populations lose their virulence, but I think there are ongoing studies to try and compare the genomes of naturalized versus the actual pathogens. One other consideration, the Food and Drug Administration has proposed a regulation in 2014 about the use of raw manure for producing crops for human consumption. They proposed a rule that 9 months would be required to elapse between actual application and harvesting of these food crops for human consumption, but there was a large argument and a large objection to this from many stakeholders, but that regulation is still pending. FDA is still considering actually applying this this time period. Aspect of soil biotic complexity is that there are studies to show that the more diverse soils are, the faster pathogens will decline when they're introduced to soils, so that the invasive pathogens that could pose human health risks are actually less likely to survive and persist in soils if they are highly biologically active and rich in entropic interactions. One other aspect is that higher trophic levels, larger fauna, are very important in increasing biodiversity because passage of bacteria and fungi and other detritus through faunal guts will actually increase contact and transfer of genes, plasmids, possibly bacteriophage, and in a sense, these in situ disturbance agents are actually enhancing biological diversity. So I'd like to just end with the question about what to do about disturbance. Plant soil disturbance really is an essential component of agriculture, but we have to understand better how to manage the biological diversity and still apply disturbance possibly at intermediate levels and optimal levels to enhance soil function. Also, it's important to remember that there are cases of land restoration and restoration and reclamation of barren areas that require human disturbance. So in a sense, this is positive disturbance where we're trying to introduce greater biological interactions. I'll end by just acknowledging my colleagues and some funding sources, but I also want to point out there is a cartoonist by the name of Callahan, and one of my favorite cartoons is a drawing of a door that goes to a psychiatric ward, and on that door is a sign, "Do not disturb any further." Now, I'd like to end by saying, well, we may still need to disturb agricultural soils for land conversion, but I would like to say perhaps we should learn how to disturb, but still think of all of the biota that are involved. Thank you.